TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The Dublin Interview with Professor Kevin Anderson. At the Paris Climate Talks in 2015, 195 countries made pledges how to keep global warming under 2 degrees Celsius, or even better, 1.5 degrees C. However, there's now very little information as to how, or if at all, these pledges are being honored. Kevin Anderson is Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester and Deputy Director of the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research. In March 2016, he came for a whirlwind speaking tour to Ireland and sat down for an interview in Dublin with John Gibbons from the National Trust for Ireland. Gibbons calls Anderson one of the world's best known and most influential and outspoken climate specialists. Here's the first part of his one-hour, no-holds-barred, exceedingly well-researched analysis, ranging from CO2 emissions in agriculture, his opinion on the million-dollar question, is it 2 degrees Celsius temperature-wise unavoidable, and what if we were to go to 4 degrees? Anderson also unpacks the false promise of green growth. He begins by giving Ireland a scorecard on fulfilling their Paris pledge.
Kevin Anderson, thank you very much, first of all, for taking the time. And I suppose you'll have had a good flavour of the landscape with regard to climate change and how Ireland is positioned, both in terms of its recent legislation and also, say, vis-a-vis our targets and so on. Would you have, as an outsider, would you have a view on how Ireland Incorporated is doing with regard to climate change? Are we grasping the nettle?
I think certainly not. I mean, we have to be very clear about this. In relation to what Ireland, of course, has signed up to in the recent Paris Agreement, which all nations of the world are signed up to, and particularly when you think Ireland is one of the wealthier countries of the world, it's wealthier per GDP, income per GDP, than the UK, and it's certainly well above the European average. No, Ireland is not doing what is necessary, anywhere near what is necessary, to deliver the sort of commitments that Ireland has signed up to in the Paris Agreement. And I think it's also fair to say that something similar could be concluded for the UK, for the EU more generally, and probably for many parts of the world. But then you come back and say, well, Ireland is a particularly wealthy nation. It has a wonderful renewable potential, probably, you know, as good as the UK's or Scotland and Wales that I've worked a bit more with, or Norway. So it has that potential. It also has a very educated workforce. And broader population. So it has everything it needs, all the wherewithal that's necessary to make the rapid transition to a low carbon energy system, and indeed a much lower carbon agricultural system that would be in line with the Paris Agreement. And at the moment, it is choosing to do very little in that direction.
Right, many politicians in Ireland and for example, people in the agricultural sector would feel that we're a small country and we've just recovering from recession, so maybe this isn't a good time to deal with climate change. Maybe it's something we can deal with in 10 or 20 years' time. What would you say to that view?
Well, it completely misunderstands the science. The one thing we're very clear about is that the temperature rise that we are already seeing, and that we are going to be seeing increasing, you know, levels of temperature increase across the century, and in fact, even just across the next few decades, that it's the emissions that we put into the atmosphere now that really matters. So though you often get a focus on things like 2030 or 2050, what really matters from a scientific perspective in relation to temperature is the total quantity of carbon dioxide we put in the atmosphere, what we call the carbon budget. So the emissions that go out into the atmosphere today and tomorrow and the day after, these are really important. They build up every single day in the atmosphere. So it completely misunderstands the science to think that we can hold back until some period in the future when we expect to be a wealthier country able to resolve these problems. That misunderstands, and I would argue to some extent deliberately misunderstands, the science underpinning climate change. And then the next part is, well, you know, Ireland is a small part of the problem. Well, every part of the world is a small part of the problem. We hear this from every sector. The aviation sector says this, the shipping sector says that, the UK has said this. You go to Beijing and Shanghai, you add those two together, its emissions are only quite small relative to the same size as the UK. So is Germany, California, again, only 2% of global emissions. So you can divide 100% of all emissions into any small numbers you want to. Using that as an argument is really very false and, again, very misleading. So I would not expect an educated population like Ireland to be making that sort of argument.
Okay. A large portion of our emissions in Ireland are attributable directly to the agriculture sector. Mm. And as you may have heard, under Food Harvest 2020 and Foodwise 2025, the government has undertaken a really large-scale expansion of our ruminant-based agriculture. And their argument is that we can do it more efficiently, for example, than the Brazilians clearing rainforests to produce beef and to produce dairy products. Is that a reasonable argument from you, with your scientific hat on?
From a climate change perspective, it clearly is not a reasonable argument. And I'm sure that anyone who's making it, who's aware of the science, can see that very clearly. You cannot hold those arguments and meet the commitments that we've signed up to in Paris. The other thing I would say, and it's really important, not just for agriculture, but for energy, the area that I'm more commonly engaged in, the climate does not care about efficiency. It has no interest in efficiency. It only cares about absolute levels of emissions. So if you're going to look at Ireland, then you have to look at what are the absolute levels of emissions. Now, you might then start to say, well, if Ireland is providing food to other parts of the world through export, then it needs to be making sure that food is provided as efficiently as possible, assuming, therefore, it's not going to be in addition to emissions from other parts of the world. So it will be substituting, say, for poor levels of agriculture elsewhere. But if that is the case, then I think measuring efficiency in terms of carbon dioxide per kilogram of beef or carbon dioxide per ton of milk or whatever it is you sell, I gather it's milk and beef are the two big issues, then that's not the appropriate way to think about this. If we are really concerned about feeding the world, then you measure it in terms of nutrition or you measure it in terms of calories. So what are the CO2 per useful calorie that you produce? Now that will almost certainly mean you have to move away from the types of agriculture you have now that are innately very high greenhouse gas emissions. You have to move away from that to other forms of agriculture that have much lower emissions of greenhouse gases per useful output of calorie or per useful unit of nutrition. The forms of measures that you're using today are, again, inappropriate and misleading.
An Irish meteorologist, Professor Ray Bates, has argued on national television in a recent debate that while he fully accepts that climate change is real and that it's occurring, that in his opinion, it is in no way serious enough to be described as a global emergency, and certainly not enough that the Irish agriculture sector should take it into consideration, for example, that it should curtail its beef and dairy expansion. His view is that the Irish national good is more important in the short term, in the medium term, than climate change, which we will deal with further down the road. And he quotes, if you like, low-range IPCC projections, as he would see them, to defend this view.
If he's following the broad framing of the IPCC, which is innately a conservative process, and that's rightly a conservative process, that's how science evolves, then his view is legitimate, but only at one end of the extreme. You then have to say, so he takes an extreme view that we are unlikely to see significant levels of climate change with current levels of emissions. Other scientists, and many more scientists, would take a view that we are likely to see very significant levels of climate change. It is then the role of the public, of civil society, of the policy makers to decide what's my attitude towards risk. I have one person here saying I think it will be at the lower end of the increase in temperature and the set of impacts, and you have many, many more scientists who are equally well qualified arguing we think it will be considerably higher. And then this becomes a risk issue. Now, if you were looking at this as a betting person, you think, well, where would I put my money? Most experts think actually it's going to be a much larger climate change signal relative to our emissions, and one expert thinks it's going to be at the lower end of that spectrum, and it's up to us to decide. Part of what feeds into that would seem to me would say, well, what are we applying this risk to? We're applying it to our globe, to our planet, to the place that we all live, that 7.3 billion people live today. And it would seem to me very foolish to take that risk that one expert, relatively one lone expert, is right and all of the others are wrong. So I think it would be a foolish mistake to go down the let's keep our fingers crossed, let's hope that climate sensitivity, as we call it, is at the lower end of the spectrum, despite the fact by far and away the majority of scientists thinks it's more likely to be at the middle to the upper end of the climate sensitivity range.
Okay. We're 3 months, Kevin, since the Paris Agreement. You were there, you attended, and I think many people seem to have come away thinking, well, that's the climate sorted anyway, yes. And now it's time to move on. We've all heard, of course, about the INDCs, which I understand are really voluntary commitments made by governments. And my understanding is that they would amount to, if fully implemented by all 195 governments, would amount to about 2.7 degree centigrade increase at one level, which I should add is well outside the safety range.
Yes, so what's happened is that all nations, or virtually all nations around the globe, submitted these pledges, these INDCs, into Paris. So this is what these nations think they will be able to deliver in terms of reducing or changing the rate of growth of their emissions, but basically between 2020 and 2030. So it's a very short time frame we're talking about. Now, not all countries had different sets of units or different dates and so forth, but there was quite a lot of different baselines. Some were absolute emission reductions, some were relative to the size of the economy or related to population size. So there were different ways that these pledges were framed quantitatively. So it is then the job of the scientific community to take this slightly messy bunch of data and sort of say, well, how does that look like it's going to play out into the future? Now, firstly, all of these pledges finish in 2030. So given that we're talking about temperature later on in the century, you have to make some estimates of what we think will happen post-2030. Now, if you're fairly optimistic about these things, you might say, well, actually, let's imagine that there's a considerably larger increase in effort towards reducing our emissions after 2030. Now, if you do that, then you can sort of say, well, it doesn't seem too unreasonable that we could be heading towards post-2030, towards a 2.7 temperature, degree centigrade temperature rise. If, however, you sort of say, well, let's imagine they carry on with roughly the sort of same level of effort that they've already spoken about, what would that look like? And that looks much more well over 3, towards 3.5 degrees C temperature-wise, which is a very significant increase over 2.7, which is already a very significant increase over the 2 degrees C that we agreed to in Paris. And actually, remember, in Paris, we also agreed to 1.5 degrees C, and that's because for the poorer parts of the world, they feel that even at 1.5 degrees C, the level of impacts are very significant, as at 2 degrees C, they see them as very destructive, if not deadly, to their societies.
Yeah, many people were surprised to hear the phrase 1.5 mentioned at Paris, given that there had been a view that that ship, so to speak, had already sailed. Would you have a view as regards the location of that ship?
Well, it's almost reached its destination. The current emissions into the atmosphere of carbon dioxide from energy are about 36 billion tonnes if you think of all per year. If you think of all the carbon dioxide emissions put into the atmosphere, then they're 40 billion tonnes. In the next few years, we'll have used up all of what we call the carbon budget, the total amount of carbon dioxide that we can put into the atmosphere for 1.5 degrees C temperature rise, according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Best estimates.
How soon, Kevin, are we talking about?
Well, we are talking probably within 5 to 8 years, we'll have used up all of that budget. So by the time we get back to review our pledges, by that time it will be too late for this ship that has set sail. So it set sail some time ago, and it's just looking to dock. Okay. And it's 1.5 degrees C port right now.
So 1.5 in Paris really was rhetorical?
It was rhetorical. It was there in many respects as a sop to the poorer parts of the world, which I think was... well, disingenuous at best.
On disingenuous, earlier in the week I heard you describe or speak around the subject of whether or not some of your scientific colleagues are involved, if you like, in self-censoring about the reality of the what the science is saying, and particularly how they communicate that to policymakers, to politicians. Could you elaborate?
Yes. Many of us who work on climate change, our conclusions beg fundamental questions about how we have framed our modern society. You know, the whole concept of economic growth, of progress, all of the things that have served us very well in modern society. The problem we have now is that our climate change science says that if we want to hold this sort of 2 degrees C temperature framework, and bear in mind that is a huge change in temperature, and it's going to occur very rapidly indeed. If we're going to hold to that sort of temperature framework, then that cannot be aligned with the current sort of economic paradigm that we have, which is one that we must always see increased material growth, that the whole of society must progress and be measured in terms of this material well-being. We can't reconcile those two. You cannot have the way that we've been growing our economies be matched with the commitments that we have made in relation to this 2 degrees C temperature threshold. And so therefore, as scientists, it's hard for us to say that, because if we say that, we're making what was seen to be a political message. Now, I think it's just a political implication of our science, but you are then having to engage in this political realm. It's also challenging because it's difficult for those of us who work in this area. We want to see positive messages. We want to live a positive life, a good life. And yet this starts to beg questions about those of us who are relatively high emitters. And of course, most of us in science, the scientific community, are in that particular elite group of high emitters. We don't want to have to change our lives. The idea we like flying to our conferences to meet colleagues and friends elsewhere, that we like to live good lives with our families and take regular holidays and so forth. That the way we have normalized our life as relatively high emitting elite is, again, that is questioned by our own science. So you can sort of see at every level, whether it's a personal level, whether it's a professional level, it's actually very difficult to speak out about what our conclusions are finding. And we also know that I think what we've seen really in the last 20 years is how strong and dominant the economic paradigm has become. In fact, I think it would be fair to say that quite a few of us who work more on the basis of sort of the science and the physics, that we have run scared of questioning the economics. And I always try to point out that we've had physics for about 13 or so billion years since the Big Bang, and it's been very, very successful in describing the world. And we've had the current economic framework for really just a few decades at most, with this obsession with growth, and that is already starting to come up against the buffers. And yet somehow we think that this ephemeral growth paradigm is more important than our understanding of fundamental physics, and we have run scared of questioning that paradigm.
And you think scientists are involved in that deception, and I use the phrase advisedly, that perhaps unintentional deception, because we still hear a lot about greening the economy and green growth. Can we replace the brown economy, Kevin, with a green economy and continue on the growth model while maintaining the possibility or entertaining the possibility of a world below 2 degrees?
No, I think the answer is a categorical no on that at the aggregate level. But I think the detail is really quite important there. As I said before, the lion's share of emissions come from a relatively small percentage of the population. 50% of global emissions come from only 10% of the global population. Now, that doesn't just mean the people in the wealthy countries. It also means a significant number of people in China. Probably 300 million people in China emit like the average European. But then a billion of them, of course, do not. So we're talking about the high emitters within our own societies as well. That particular group need to make radical reductions in their levels of emissions. And for them, without a doubt, in the current way that we would measure our success within our society, they will not be having a win-win future. They will be seeing significant, what we would normally define as reductions in our material well-being. Now, at the same time as we see that, some of the poorer people in our societies, now I don't just mean in the poorer parts of the world, but indeed there as well, but also within Ireland or within the UK, some of those people, we need to see increases in their energy consumption, increases in their material well-being, and that their emissions will likely in the short term go up as they use more energy, which will likely be more fossil fuel energy. So for them, we expect to see an improvement in the quality of life, their material well-being, but that has to be compensated for by people like me and the other high emitters making even more deep reductions in our emissions. So on aggregate, what we will not be able to see is win-win and green growth. But when we break that up, that basically means it's the wealthy of us that are responsible for the lion's share of the emissions, and of course are responsible for the climate change we've already seen and that we've locked into the system. We will have to make significant changes to how we live our lives, and that will not be a green growth future for us.
I mean, the wealthy 1%, 5%, 10%, that group also has the closest access to political power, to economic power, to power within the business community. How exactly, and I appreciate this is a bit of a reach for a climate scientist, but how exactly do you tell the prosperous high emitters that the jig is up?
I think probably for some of them that's the case, but also, I mean, a lot of high-emitting people, like people around the world, the lion's share of people around the world are good people trying to live good lives, looking after their family, concerned about their local society and community. So I think we have to tap into that social conscience that we all have. Even the wealthiest people in society have that, at least some of them do.
Sure.
So we have to try and tap into that. It's not just about their future, it's about their children's future. And even many people also do actually have some degree of care and compassion for people elsewhere in the world. Now, it doesn't seem to me that we care that much about elsewhere in the world, but collectively we still want to try to ensure that our lifestyle does not impose too severe impacts on others elsewhere. So I think we have to sort of tap into that. It's not quite altruistic, but there's an element of altruistic concern that we all have, regardless of our income. We can also talk about it being a relatively short-term, a temporary change, because once we've got low-carbon energy supply in place, in theory at least, from a carbon perspective alone, we can go back to the levels of inequality that we have today. You know, I personally think that's a mistake, and I think there would be big problems from a broader sustainability sort of agenda. But from a carbon perspective, once you've got low carbon or zero carbon energy in place, we can consume as much energy as we want to do. The other thing for us as scientists, actually in some respects it's a little bit easier for us to communicate. As long as I'm not concerned about whether people like or dislike my conclusions, my only concern is do they agree or disagree with my conclusions. And that's really, I think, the only real role of academics and scientists is to do, we do careful, robust research and we communicate it vociferously and clearly. So for scientists, it's much easier for me to turn around to the wealthier ones in our society and say, this is the level of reductions that you and people like you, and people like me included, would have to make if we are to hold to a 2 degree C framing. That may be unpopular, but as a scientist, I'm not interested. I'm not there for a popularity contest. That's the role of politicians. I'm there simply to provide information to the policymakers, to wider civil society, about the rates of change that we need to make in our current levels of emissions if we are to meet this 2 degree C framing of dangerous climate change.
Okay. You've taken an unusual, well, some would regard an unusual personal step, I think about 10, 11 years ago, that you decided to stop flying, which as an academic, a high-flying academic, if I might say, that must have been presented a lot of practical challenges. Why do you think that's important, or is it important?
I think it is important, and I don't think it's just the flying, but and I tried to make some other changes to some areas of my life. But the reason I probably flag up the flying is it's emblematic, firstly, of two things. Firstly, it's emblematic of what we see as progress. You know, the more we fly, the more we can, and we have, it's like a positional good. You know, I flew to the States 5 times last year for these important meetings. It adds not only to what we think is, you know, good about ourselves, but we think it reflects well for other people looking at us that we're this high flyer. There's something about that that's attractive. So I think to actually try to unpick that, undermine it, to say we can still run good, successful careers without having to resort to these incredibly high carbon forms of transport. So I think it's important from an emblematic point of view. The emissions are much less important. No doubt they all add up. If people like me and others start to make these changes, that's important from an emissions point of view. But most important is the message that we're showing or we're demonstrating to others, that you can live and work in an academic community, in my case, and have a good, successful career without having this enormously high carbon footprint. And what's also particularly important about aviation, unlike all other forms of transport, it's the one form of transport that looks incredibly difficult to decarbonize. So when I decide to fly, I am sending a market signal to carry on building and expanding our airports, which is occurring, of course, everywhere, to buy more planes, which all of this is locking us up into very high carbon futures. Aviation within the UK represents about 7% of our emissions. Globally, it's about 2 to 3% depending how you measure it. Now, that's the emissions equivalent between the UK and Germany, just from aviation emissions, and it is growing much more rapidly than any country's emissions, with no prospect of us finding a low-carbon alternative. So when you put all of that together, you know, from technically, socially, symbolically, every facet of aviation is playing against the agenda to avoid dangerous climate change. And I think it's incumbent on those of us who work on climate change to demonstrate we think the issue is so important, the climate change issue is so important, we're prepared to make those sorts of changes. How on earth can we expect the people who are 32,000 feet beneath us to believe our message about making rapid changes and deep changes to their levels of emissions when those of us who are pulling the science together carry on with very high carbon footprints and lifestyles? So I think making the change adds credibility to our research, even though obviously it doesn't increase the quality of our research, but it adds credibility to the research.
Okay. You mentioned a little earlier about the reality of a 3 to 4C world further down the road. Some people say by 2100. I've heard projections more towards 2050, 2060 of that possibility if we continue on the business as usual pathway. What, in your opinion, would a 4-degree world look like?
Yeah, well, firstly, looking at the timescales, Professor Richard Betts from the University of Exeter, and also involved in the Met Office in the UK, he has made the point repeatedly that if we are unlucky on climate sensitivity and we're sort of the upper end of it, we could see 4 degrees C by around about 2060. Now, he's not saying that's likely, he's just saying that that is a plausible scientific outcome of our current levels of emissions growth. The problem with 4 degrees C really is that, I mean, I often describe it as a different planet. It's not the planet we live on. That will bring about fundamental changes to every facet of our planet. It will change the ecosystems. We will destroy, well, even before that sort of temperature, we'll destroy all of the emblematic ecosystems that we can think of, you know, the the Amazon rainforest will be significantly reduced and probably almost wiped out in any sense that we would recognize it today. We would wipe out things like the Barrier Reef. So all of those big ecosystems would go. But much more importantly than that, well, equally important to that are the other sort of smaller things, like, for instance, the change in pollination insects, the insects that provide our agriculture. Without those, we are going to really struggle. 9 billion people having to self-pollinate all of our crops. That becomes a challenge. You then start to think, well, what about the extremes? A 4 degrees C temperature rise, and remember it's a global average, which is a very unhelpful way to describe these things. We use 2 degrees C and 4 degrees C.
And it's land surface and sea surface.
And exactly, it's a global average. Yeah. Most of the planet is made up of oceans. The oceans have a high thermal mass. They take a lot longer to warm up. And therefore, a 4 degrees C global average is probably 5 to 5.5 degrees C on land. But even then you say, well, what's the difference? What does that mean during extremes of weather? That means during the heat waves that we might see. So for instance, the 2003 heatwave in Europe, where 20 to 30,000 people died, you'd be adding about a 6 to 8 degrees C temperature signal on top of that heatwave, and of course it could be prolonged. So you start to see, our systems, our infrastructures could not cope with that heatwave. And I say a lot of people as a consequence died. You're adding a huge temperature signal on top of that. There's no way that our infrastructure across Europe could cope with those sorts of temperatures. We would be those sorts of extremes. But it's the same for flooding around the world. It's the same for droughts around the world. We would be changing fundamentally the weather patterns around the planet. That would affect food production, as the Met Office has pointed out previously, at 4 degrees C, perhaps a 40% reduction in some of the staple crop from the southern latitude. At the same time, we're trying to get 9 billion people living on this planet. So, everything from our material, physical infrastructure that we have constructed to allow us to lead good lives, that would be, fall far short of what is necessary to deal with the weather extremes that will come along with a 4 degrees C temperature rise, right through to things like our food production, when you've got large populations desperate for food, issues of migration at very high levels would become hugely significant. And on top of all of that is layered a significant and fundamental, profound change, really, to the global ecosystems, to the way nature works on our planet today, all occurring really at the same sort of speed as when we were hit by a meteorite. It's really from any geological or natural time frame, we are hitting the planet that fast, that hard, and consciously. We know we are doing it. The meteorite didn't know the damage it was going to cause, but we know we're causing that damage, and we know that we can do something to avert it.
That was the first part of a one-hour interview with Kevin Anderson, Professor of Energy and Climate Change at the University of Manchester and Deputy Director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. He spoke with John Gibbons from the National Trust for Ireland in Dublin in March 2016. Come back for part two when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio's free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.